Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. This is the second episode in our presentation of the 2020 Spokesman Review Summer Stories short fiction series. If you missed yesterday's episode, you can find it on our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org, or on The Bookshelf podcast. Tonight, we'll hear stories from Bruce Holbert and Johanna Stoberock. As with all of this year's stories, they're responding to the theme Mount St. Helens, looking back 40 years to the historic eruption of that volcano in May of 1980. Our first story is read by the author, Bruce Holbert. He is a retired high school English teacher and the author of three novels. His second, The Hour of Lead, won the Washington State Book Award for Fiction. A graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, Holbert's fiction and essays have appeared in the Iowa Review, the Antioch Review, the New Orleans Review, the Santa Fe Writers Project, River, and the New York Times. Here's Bruce Holbert reading his story, Mayday.
Mayday by Bruce Holbert. College hadn't worked out for Yeller. He'd not even learned to drink well. By spring, his second sophomore year at Eastern Washington University, Eastern Washington State College 3 years before, their mascot, the Savages, little Indians with tomahawks, remained in the athletic facility's brick walkway. Yeller was an eagle and a fairly lost bird. He opted for college to avoid construction work. It's not that he didn't respect working with your hands. He was no good at it. Upon graduation, most of his high school classmates migrated to the Tri-Cities and employment at the nuclear plant. Iron workers, boiler makers, machinists, welders, operators, all the union books were open. But Yeller could ruin an anvil with a feather duster. He didn't trust himself on a project that could melt half the state. Recently, he took work selling knives, strong enough to cut metal, out of a briefcase. A customer once inquired why she would want such a knife. "Don't you think it's better to have a knife that cuts metal and not need it than to need a knife to cut metal and not have it?" Yeller responded. He was a sincere person and eager for his client's comfort. He believed every kitchen ought to have proper equipment. In the tavern, he chatted up all those he knew, locals and out-of-towners and students. The knives made excellent gifts for parents. Those he didn't know, he introduced himself and hunted for the portion of them that bought things. He never felt off duty. It wore him out. One tavern breakfast, he found himself with no one on either stool beside him. Others picked through omelets or stabbed their over-easy eggs with toast, but Yeller no longer noticed the bustle. The muscles in his shoulders relaxed and his head lolled a little. It was as calm as he had ever been. He let his breakfast sit. He didn't drink his orange juice. For an entire song, he didn't move. Not the frozen hide-and-seek sort of stillness, but tranquil without effort, like a tree or a mountain. A jukebox song finished, then another. The gears in his head gently engaged. They pressed him someplace poorly lit. He squinted. Light clung to the ground, low and ethereal. It seemed to emit from underneath. Shadows appeared like rays, not zombies, nor frightening, nor silent, nor depressed. Eventually, Yeller recognized he must return to the bar stool and his breakfast and ordinary chaos in the room. He determined he would retain this moment, though. There would be signs. The bartender refilled his coffee. Yeller glanced up. The man wore a simple bill cap, but stitched above its brim was a yellow hoop, and inside a silhouetted rodeo rider aboard a rearing horse. "What time is it?" Yeller asked. The bartender glanced at his watch. "Half past one." "What day?" "Sunday." "The haberdasheries are all closed. Tomorrow," Yeller thought. Tomorrow he would become a cowboy. 10 minutes later, a drunk woman approached him. Her husband required dialysis, and she wanted to winter him in Arizona. She offered him a lottery ticket for $10. "I can get my own for half that," Yeller told her. "But who would it help?" she asked. He didn't have $10. Breakfast was the end of his cash. He offered her a knife. "It cuts metal," he said. Yeller exchanged the knife for the ticket. "It's sad for me to lose this," she said, "but it may be good luck to you." Outside, the sun hurt Yeller's eyes. He determined today to visit the library. Tomorrow was his midterm in Intro to Biology, a class he hadn't attended in 2 weeks. He'd encountered a woman in the back row. She'd asked if he knew where to get extra pencils. He offered her his. When the professor began his lecture, she scratched words furiously into her notebook, her pretty face bunched with attention. She did not notice Yeller wrote nothing, nor did she return the pencil after. The weeks following, Yeller occasionally encountered her on campus. Once his eyes met hers, but Yeller saw nothing like recognition. In fact, her nose wrinkled as if she'd smelled something disagreeable. Then she gazed down at her books and hurried past. Thinking of it hurt Yeller's teeth. On the sidewalk outside, people pointed west at a black line that appeared to be just horizon. Someone with a Walkman radio said a mountain blew up. "That mountain," the person said, "the one in the news." Yeller continued to the library. There he chose a study carrel on the top floor. The black, he thought, horizon had crept forward. Inside it, beautiful purple lightning fluttered, too distant to provide the accompanying thunder. Yeller smelled something like dust. The black cloud climbed the sky, pressing the blue it had not yet erased bluer. Soon the whole of the sky had surrendered. Outside, street lights flickered orange light. Despite it being midday, their luminescence dimmed to dots and falling ash. Yeller watched a football player he recognized appear, then disappear, then appear again as he made his way to a dorm. Yeller wondered if the man knew he was magic, not just a witness to a trick, but the trick itself. The library's overhead lights flickered, its indicator for closing. "An emergency," an assistant said. She checked out books, though, like business as usual. She didn't know this new sky cut your lungs when you breathed it. She didn't know the Safeway would soon have no food or beer. No one knew removing the portion over them would require all summer. No one knew it would turn concrete sludge when wet. No one knew Harry Truman was dead or the Toutle River was choked with debris. No one predicted the event would deliver the president. A disaster, the news would call it. It seemed something else to Yeller. And he was now a person with authority, a prophet. A minor one, yes, not worthy of a chapter in anyone's Bible or a cable television show or a 1-800 number. He patted his chest. The ticket in his pocket remained. He hadn't studied the numbers. They wouldn't be those listed in the paper tomorrow, though, and his name would not appear in the next day as a winner. He foresaw this. Yeller did not forecast surviving 2 automobile accidents in his own life, or suffering an arrest and 2 nights of jail on a cop's mistake. He didn't see 7 months later an encounter with a woman he'd married. He didn't divine she would remain the following years. He didn't anticipate fathering 3 children who would overlook his inadequacies and phone each Sunday after they left home. Apprehending these things would have been a relief, yes, but a distraction. A seer's gift isn't the extent of his vision, Yeller determined. It's how thoroughly one includes himself in the minute you're in. Anyone could forecast the next sunrise, or that in 7 billion years the sun would explode. A volcano's eruption, though, anticipating that requires your whole presence. Yeller wasn't certain how he'd manage such a feat. He was unsure he could repeat it, but even wondering that seemed staring too far up the road. Later, in the ashy pall, Yeller encountered the woman from his biology class once more. Her body bent forward, head down, as if she were a drill boring through all this. He watched her pass, oblivious to those around her attempting to press ash into something they could throw, or others making themselves angels as they did as children in the snow. He imagined her possessing the pencil still, perhaps for notes in other classes or to-do lists or parents' correspondence. But how did all her scratching and erasing serve her? She balanced equations and simplified functions, yet she had not discerned what Yeller had. There would be no midterm. She marched away from Yeller and the revelers, whose shadows flattened by the opaque light and the heaviest sky imaginable, were liberated from such ordinary concerns. She could not hear their laughter, not drunken or cynical. This laughter was the laughter of children, babies even, as if the seers were remembering just now, grace was everywhere.
That was Bruce Holbert, reading his short story, Mayday, one of this year's Spokesman Review Summer Stories. The theme of this year's short fiction series is Mount St. Helens. This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Our next story is by Johanna Stoberock. She is the author of the novels Pigs and City of Ghosts. The 2019 recipient of the Artist Trust's Gar LaSalle Storyteller Award, 2016 runner-up for the Italo Calvino Prize for Fiction, and a 2012 Jack Straw Fellow. Stoberock's work has appeared in the Chicago Review of Books, Lit Hub, The Best of the Net Anthology, and elsewhere. She lives in Walla Walla, where she teaches in the composition and first-year programs at Whitman College. Here's Zan Agzigian, the host of Sound Space on Spokane Public Radio, reading Johanna Stoberock's short story, Miriam and Clara, 1980.
Miriam and Clara, 1980, by Johanna Stoberock. Clara was 15, but when Miriam looked at her, she could see her as a baby still. She'd been a fat baby, and Miriam had complained endlessly about what it felt like to carry her. Aching back, aching shoulders, constantly wrestling with an animal that wouldn't take responsibility for its own weight. But now she'd give anything for those clearly assignable aches. Anything to have her baby press a fat cheek into her face, slobbering her baby slobber onto Miriam's skin. Maybe they'd made a mistake only having one baby. She'd always had enough, though, with Clara. She'd have enough holding her little girl's hand and chatting with her before bed and brushing her hair while she squirmed and squirmed and then screamed. Miriam hadn't known she'd be able to be cruel before she became a mother. She didn't know she had it in her, that everyday cruelty of turning an animal child into a human being. But she was capable. She'd even come to see the cruelty of taming as a kind of strength. And now, Clara wouldn't give her the time of day. Bill told her to wait. He told her all kids vanish when they hit a certain age. Give her time, he said. She's just figuring herself out. Kids do that. She'll come back. He was right. Miriam knew he was right. But it was different between Clara and her. For one thing, Bill had a life beyond their house. When Clara was born, they decided Miriam would stay home with her. Miriam hadn't ever really liked working anyway, and childcare cost so much that it seemed like, as long as they could afford it, it made sense for her to be a full-time mom. Clara sat at the table now, eating a bowl of cereal. Her hair was black. That was new. It had happened secretly overnight. Her nails were green. She was chewing in time to some private music in her head. She used to hum when she ate, so sweet. Kids at school had teased her about it, but Miriam had never wanted her to stop. She didn't hum out loud anymore, but it seemed like there was always some rhythm circling around inside her that Miriam could see, but not find inside herself. Do you need a ride home from school? Miriam asked. Clara didn't move. Had she even heard her? I could pick you up. Happy to do it. Clara kept chewing. Your loss, Miriam said. Clara shrugged. She left the house to wait for the bus without saying goodbye. Miriam watched her through the window. Her daughter, visible as always, but barely recognizable. The news was filled with talk of the mountain erupting. 300 miles from their eastern corner of the state, so far away, it was hard to imagine that it mattered. But every night, scientists got on TV with warnings. Violence was coming, fire and molten rock. The scientists knew it would happen, even if they didn't know exactly when. Prepare yourself, they said. Get to safety. Don't stay. Miriam didn't think they could possibly be speaking to her. 300 miles, so far away. But it felt like there was something personal about those warnings. She just couldn't figure out what. It was hard to think of mountains, at least mountains here in the Northwest, as volcanoes. Volcanoes were supposed to be on tropical islands. They were supposed to send showers of sparks into the air like fireworks, and their hot lava was supposed to travel down to the ocean in thick, glowing threads, and anybody who lived close to them was supposed to have already figured out how to organize their lives around the regular eruptions. Driving west, the giant mountains punctuating the Cascades seemed like ghosts. Mount Hood never appeared gradually. It was always just suddenly there, floating, white, and from another world. Or Mount Adams, just past Yakima. Sometimes she'd get a sideways glimpse of it, and then when she looked directly, it would be gone. Or Mount Rainier in Seattle, when she was in college, when she met Bill. They used to joke about Rainier haunting them. It seemed like you'd be looking at the horizon and it would be empty, and then you'd turn away for a second. When you look back, the mountain would be there, covered in snow, larger than a mountain should be, like some kind of sign waiting to be read. But a sign of what? She'd loved its unknown quality then, that sense of something so much larger than the rest of the world, so resonant with meaning in its cold, stony way, but so impossible to understand. She'd never been to Mount St. Helens. She wasn't sure she'd ever seen it, but she imagined it the same as those other ghostly giants, snow-covered, appearing and disappearing at will, a sign of something more than a place itself, a sign that refused to surrender meaning. She could use a sign now, she thought. May was beautiful. Miriam's father had always said that the first week of May was when you could trust that every tree would have its leaves. And now, just past the first week, she couldn't stop thinking about him. The kind of green that settled from on high was pale and aching with life. The last time she'd seen her father, his hands had looked bleached like old leaves, veins visible, the skin nearly rubbed off. And now, barely a year since his passing, she felt him everywhere. I was 15 once, she thought. Did I seem ready to erupt in the same way that Clara does? She tried to remember back to when she was a kid. It had been her and her father alone. Had he watched her eat breakfast before heading off to school? She remembered sitting at the table by herself. She remembered the house mostly dark at night, just the light in her bedroom while she finished her homework. The world had been quieter then. She asked Bill what he remembered from his childhood, and he just shook his head. If only her father was still alive. If only she could ask him what it had felt like to be her father when she was still a child. If only she could ask him whether he'd waited for a sign as well. Clara had started taking walks at night. Miriam couldn't think of a reason to tell her no. After dinner, Clara would clear her plate, go to her room, and then come back into the kitchen and say, "I'm going out for a while." Then the door would shut behind her. "Say something to her," Miriam said to Bill. But when he tried, Clara just looked at him, and the longer she looked, the more he forgot what he wanted to say. "Stand up to her," Miriam said. "What's there to stand up to her about?" he said. "She's taking a walk. We don't want her to feel like a prisoner here. We don't want her to feel like we're her enemies." "She's ours to protect," Miriam said. "She's ours to trust," Bill said. On a Saturday night in mid-May, the heads on the television were practically screaming. The earth was about to split open. Walls of rock would turn liquid. Fire would blaze. Ash would be pushed up into the sky so thick and heavy that it would cover the sun and turn day to night. "These are not predictions," Miriam heard. "These are facts. This is science. This is real." And outside, the street lamps glowed the same soft light they always glowed. "I'm going out," Clara said. Miriam looked at Bill. Bill looked at the television. The scientists looked back, opened their mouths, practically screaming their warnings. The door shut softly. Just a month ago, it would have slammed. But now, Clara seemed more interested in slipping away than in announcing her departure with a bang. The night was cold. Miriam could feel the chill sneaking in. She grabbed Clara's jacket and ran out behind her. Her daughter needed freedom, but she didn't need to be cold while she was looking for it. But Clara wasn't anywhere, not on the sidewalks lit in circles by the street lamps, not down the street where the town ended and the county began and street lamps gave way to front porch lights that, as usual, were mostly turned off. Night had fallen. It was dark now in the world. Dark. And her daughter was gone. Miriam moved quickly, certain that she was moving faster than Clara would be, certain that wherever her daughter might be going, she would be able to find her, would overtake her, would make sure she was safe. A mother should be able to do that. Her daughter was ahead of her, as certain as any vision she'd ever had. But she didn't find her. The night stayed dark. Up ahead, the road turned into a bridge that crossed the creek. They used to spend hours there tossing pine cones into the water and watching them float away. Miriam stopped on the bridge, out of breath, and leaned against the cement railing. She could hear the water down below, though at first she couldn't see it. It seemed that all the different darknesses of night blended together here. But the longer she looked, the more she was certain that a part of the darkness was changing shape. "Bring my daughter back. Bring my daughter back, please. Bring my daughter back." The words rattled in her head, and she imagined the black water taking her words away, carrying them onward to an invisible part of the world that might or might not listen. When she got home, Bill shrugged and nodded his head towards Clara's bedroom door. Closed, as always. The mountain erupted at 8:30 the next morning. Power beyond imagining. Then quiet. And then, at 11 a.m., 300 miles away, ash began to fall. Miriam banged on Clara's bedroom door, and Clara opened it, rubbing sleep from her eyes. A scowl already settled on her face. "Get dressed," Miriam said, and Clara did. The two of them stepped out onto the street, ash falling around them like snow, piling and piling up in the warm May day, as soft as feathers, as soft as a mother's touch. The new green leaves disappeared, covered by inches of dust, but underneath there somewhere, Miriam knew there was green still. And for just that moment, She trusted that it would emerge again, and when it did, she would forget all this and remember that the condition of the world is meant to be joy.
That was Zan Egzigian reading Miriam and Clara, 1980, by Johanna Stoberock. Zan is the host of Sound Space, an eclectic music program heard Sunday nights from 9 to 11 p.m. here on KPBX, Spokane Public Radio. You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. We'll be back tomorrow evening with two more short stories from this year's Spokesman Review Summer Stories Short Fiction Project. Tomorrow, we'll bring you stories by Spokane authors Ben Goldfarb and Chris Dennison. If you want to listen again, you can find this and other past episodes of The Bookshelf, including last night's episode of our summer stories, on our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org, or on The Bookshelf podcast. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini.